Loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm John Kiriakou, and I'm joined in studio by co-host Brian Becker. In this hour, we take a look at the breaking news of the day. First, a journalists group, Reporters Committee for Freedom of the Press, has filed a federal motion asking that all documents related to a pending indictment of Julian Assange in the Eastern District of Virginia be unsealed. Federal prosecutors oppose the motion and say that a recent leak that seemed to indicate that a secret indictment already exists was inadvertent and should not be construed as confirmation. Judge Leonie Brinkema, who reserves all national security cases for herself, will make a decision. Next, The Guardian is reporting today that Paul Manafort held secret meetings with Julian Assange in the Ecuadorian embassy in London in 2013, 2015, and 2016. Manafort calls the report 100% false, and WikiLeaks said there is literally nothing true about it. Meanwhile, the special counsel's office says that Manafort has violated the terms of his plea deal by continually lying to investigators, and he should be sentenced immediately. Then Nikki Haley, the U.S. ambassador to the United Nations, accused Russia on Monday of taking outlaw actions against Ukrainian ships in an incident at sea this weekend and vowed that sanctions punishing Russia's annexation of Crimea would continue. Haley said, quote, "Outlaw actions like this one continue to make an improvement in U.S.-Russian relations impossible. The United States will maintain its Crimea-related sanctions against Russia. Indeed, further Russian escalation of this kind will only make matters worse," unquote. Donald Trump's comments, however, struck a different tone from Haley's. And finally, the Mississippi Senate race will be decided in a runoff election today that pits former Congressman and Agriculture Secretary Mike Espy against incumbent Republican Senator Cindy Hyde-Smith. Hyde-Smith has found herself at the center of controversy recently over her previous support of Confederate symbols and monuments. Espy is the strongest possible Democrat to challenge Hyde-Smith, but polls show that the Republicans will keep the seat. That's all coming up next on Loud and Clear. Now we turn to the Federal Court for the Eastern District of Virginia in Alexandria. A journalist group, Reporters Committee for Freedom of the Press, has filed a federal motion asking that all documents related to a pending indictment of Julian Assange in the Eastern District be unsealed. Federal prosecutors oppose the motion and say that a recent leak that seemed to indicate that a secret indictment already exists was inadvertent and should not be construed as confirmation. Judge Leonie Brinkema, who reserves all national security cases for herself, will make a decision. We're joined from Moscow by Susie Dawson. She is an activist and the president of the Internet Party of New Zealand. Welcome, Susie.
Thank you so much for having me.
Susie, you and I have had this conversation 100 times in the past 3 years. We were confident that Julian would likely be indicted, and it would be in the Eastern District of Virginia, and it would be under Leonie Brinkema. And that seems to be the case. Susie, the hearing was at 10 o'clock a.m. Eastern time. What's at stake for Julian and for WikiLeaks?
Well, I think there's a lot at stake for Julian and for WikiLeaks. Obviously, his liberty, first and foremost, and the question of whether or not he is likely to be extradited to the United States and or prosecuted. However, there's much more at stake more broadly for media, journalists and publishers worldwide, because what this potential indictment represents is really the end of investigative journalism. The conduct that Julian is accused of is actually standard journalistic functions, speaking to sources, procuring documents. This is something that reporters across the world do every single day. And I think, to me, the significance of the hearing today is actually that for the first time, we see a major press freedom organization litigating essentially in favor of Julian, taking actions in court to try to protect press freedom.
Susie Dawson, Julian Assange and WikiLeaks have published so many documents that governments and corporate powers and others did not want us, we, the people, to know about. Many, many media sources used it, at least as a secondary source. And I'm talking about the New York Times, CNN, Washington Post, Time Magazine, Newsweek. They were all glad to use it. Has anything been published by WikiLeaks that isn't true?
No, there is no case in the last more than a decade, any document being published by WikiLeaks that was not a true document. So they have an impeccable record of publishing. And I think it's pretty obvious that given the scale and the nature of the crimes that have been exposed in their publishing, because they have published evidence of war crimes, they have published extremely serious materials, historic and important material, that they should be absolutely protected and lauded for their service to journalism.
You know, I think that question doesn't get asked very often, John.
I think you're exactly right. And it's critically important.
Yeah, Julian Assange is facing possibly a sealed indictment, maybe going to prison if the government got its way. For doing what? For publishing the truth.
The truth.
The truth, because that nobody is arguing that what WikiLeaks has published is untrue.
That's why people are attacking the messenger, because they don't like the message. That's why when WikiLeaks publishes something that embarrasses an organization or a government, the response is to attack Julian as being in the pocket of Donald Trump or in the pocket of Vladimir Putin or hating Hillary Clinton and handing the election to Donald Trump. They don't attack the information. They only attack him.
Exactly. Just like, Susie, just like the DNC leadership told people about the WikiLeaks release of Podesta emails and other emails. Don't read them. Don't read them. Don't read them, because the source is an impure source. And of course, by that, they meant that WikiLeaks was just an agent of Russia or of Russian intelligence. Again, there's no evidence that's been proved, that's been offered to show that. And WikiLeaks has absolutely denied that.
Yeah, you're correct that there is no evidence whatsoever of any collusion with Russia. But also, the actions of the US and UK governments here are effectively serving states like Russia, like China, like Saudi Arabia. Because what are they demonstrating? They're demonstrating that it's okay to thumb your nose at two UN decisions where the US and the UK have been instructed to respect Julian's asylum and to grant him free passage and even to compensate him. And they've refused to do any of that. And now with this idea of a pending prosecution, these indictments against Julian, what message is that sending to Russia or to China or Saudi, or, you know, pick your country that is traditionally been seen as being hostile to press freedom? It's telling them, hey, it's fine for you to use to extend your jurisdiction internationally and to prosecute or persecute or extradite journalists for publishing true documents that you feel may violate your various secrecy laws.
Susie, there is an article in the Guardian newspaper today, and it's Dateline Quito, and it's talking about Julian meeting secretly with Paul Manafort. Now, WikiLeaks has denied it adamantly. And Manafort released a statement this morning saying that the report is 100% false. I'm surprised that this article is Dateline Quito and not London. And it seems to me to be a planted story. So why would a story like this come out? What would the point be of trying to connect Julian with Paul Manafort? And why would it come out now?
Well, I think it's an act of desperation on the part of the intelligence agencies in particular, but more broadly, all opponents of Julian Assange and WikiLeaks. The time, it's clearly timed to try to counteract the positive press that's been coming out in recent days and weeks in support of Julian and WikiLeaks, and particularly around this court hearing today. It's essentially a distraction. So WikiLeaks have said that it is categorically false. Manafort did not meet with Julian Assange at any time, let alone in 2013, 15, and 16, as is being claimed in that article. One of the co-authors, Luke Harding, as you mentioned, has a long, long history of being involved in these anti-WikiLeaks, anti-Julian Assange smear pieces that never quite pan out. He's built somewhat of a career by being a journalist, writing about topics for which he has no access. I'm thinking Edward Snowden here, who he wrote an entire book about without ever having spoken to or had access to even once. And likewise with Julian Assange, he's consistently written about WikiLeaks and Julian Assange without having any access or even being able to secure the most perfunctory comment from the organization. So he really has no credibility. And he's been working in conjunction with a pro-US, pro-empire, anti-WikiLeaks forces inside of Ecuador. And this has been continuing for some time now.
Yeah, so the headline is, Manafort held secret talks with Assange in Ecuadorian embassy, sources say. They say that he met three times. The Guardian article by Luke Harding, who has also written a book, of course, about Russian collusion, so-called, and who, in an interview with Aaron Maté, was essentially destroyed by Aaron Maté, who just insisted that he actually produced some facts. And, of course, right. Luke Harding could not produce facts. WikiLeaks has absolutely denied this, as we've talked about. Manafort, too, has denied this. But even when I'm looking in my email box right now, Susie, I'm looking at Alternet, a progressive liberal site. They've just published an email. It came out like a couple hours ago. Paul Manafort held secret meetings with WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange in 2016, colon, and then it says report. The headline of Alternet is such that you cannot, if you're looking at it quickly, come away from the conclusion that this is an established fact. It's not an established fact at all. In fact, it's not true. Or at least WikiLeaks and Paul Manafort say it's not true. WikiLeaks, Susie, I think said they're betting The Guardian $1 million about the truthfulness of this story. That's a, you know, they said, okay, if it's true, let's bet $1 million and see if it's true or not. Go ahead.
Look, the Guardian has a long history of publishing, you know, smears of Julian Assange, which are completely absent of any facts whatsoever. Their recent reporting surrounding the conditions inside the embassy, suggesting, you know, at face value, taking the claims of Ecuador that Julian should be spending more time housekeeping or on domestic chores or looking after his cat. I mean, it's deflection, it's distraction. They allow the real news and the real implications of the issue to just slide past them while they fixate on these tabloid narratives. Now, you've mentioned Alternet. I have fond, disturbingly fond memories of Alternet from the days of Occupy Wall Street, when they were proclaiming that the FBI and DHS definitely had no involvement in monitoring Occupy. And the editor of Alternet, then editor Joshua Holland, was voraciously attacking the activist Naomi Wolf, who had been presenting evidence that, yes, FBI and DHS were involved in monitoring Occupy. So it's unfortunate that some of these progressive publications like to go to bat for the establishment and for the state, and that they will even participate in smearing truth tellers like then Naomi Wolf or now Julian Assange. But if we just, you know, just zoom out a bit and look at the bigger picture, this is a year in which WikiLeaks and Julian Assange have gone from really being almost socially unacceptable to support in the wake of the 2016 election to where now in November they have all of the big guys on side. You know, we've had the UN rulings. Now we have the Reporters Committee for the Freedom of the Press litigating in the Eastern District Court of Virginia. We have statements from Human Rights Watch. We've had recent statement from Amnesty International in Australia. We've had, I think, nearly 80 major whistleblowers, journalists, celebrities, activists, and academics across the globe participating in online vigil events in support of Julian Assange and WikiLeaks. And particularly in the last 2 weeks, there has been a huge upsurge in what we would call blue tick accounts, well-known celebrity journalist accounts who seem to have finally seen the writing on the wall and realized that if they don't speak up about this, that they are next. And I think this increasing crescendo of support for Julian and for WikiLeaks is not really being openly acknowledged, but it is evident all around us. And I think we should take a moment to note that.
Yes, there is a groundswell. It's a true global groundswell of support for Julian Assange and WikiLeaks. And we have to say, John, to our audience that Susie Dawson, our guest, and others like her have been so important in terms of generating grassroots mobilization.
That's
tirelessly.
Right.
It's now paying off. This is a David and Goliath fight, but it's a fight that every person has a stake in the outcome.
You're absolutely right. We were very pleased to be joined from Moscow by Susie Dawson. Susie is an activist and the president of the Internet Party of New Zealand. You're listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be back after a short break.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
The Guardian is reporting today that Paul Manafort held secret meetings with Julian Assange in the Ecuadorian embassy in London in 2013, 2015, and 2016. Manafort calls the report 100% false, and WikiLeaks said there is literally nothing true about it. Meanwhile, the special counsel's office says that Manafort has violated the terms of his plea deal by continually lying to investigators, and he should be sentenced immediately. We're joined from Minnesota by Colleen Rowley. She's a former FBI special agent who in 2002 was named Time Magazine Person of the Year, along with two other whistleblowers. And we're joined from New York by Daniel Lazar. He's a journalist and the author of three books, The Frozen Republic, The Velvet Coup, and America's Undeclared War. Welcome back, Daniel and Colleen. Good to have you.
Thanks for having us.
Yes, thanks.
Colleen, let me start with you. Let's just make a huge assumption here that there were meetings between Paul Manafort and Julian Assange. Why would that be important?
Well, of course, all of the things we don't know about why Mueller is now alleging that Manafort hasn't told the truth. So there's all these questions about what he may have already divulged to Mueller, or what he may have held back, or what Mueller may have wanted him to say, but he didn't do. He wouldn't say. So these are the questions. And my knowledge of plea deals, the process of plea deals, is that there's something that's not meeting the eye here, because the government, the prosecutors will sit down with somebody and get a proffer first before they offer a plea deal. Now, if the person tells the truth in the proffer and they say, well, that's enough info, that's good, that's exactly what we wanted to hear, we'll give you a deal. With Manafort, either he made them think he was saying something that they thought was good enough, or in fact, he never said anything, but Mueller said, but we can get more out of him later, or we can get him to go further than what he said in the proffer. That's kind of unusual, frankly, because usually the prosecutors want it nailed down. So this meeting, the meetings with Julian Assange, yeah, they're going to be known or not known, because obviously everybody who went into that Ecuador embassy all those years was being carefully documented. And Manafort would not have, in his wildest dreams, have imagined that he could lie or dissemble about having met with Julian Assange. But there are lots and lots of people, probably hundreds if not thousands of people, met with Assange in the Ecuador embassy. So the big issue is, you know, what happened in those meetings. And certainly the meetings occurred before Manafort, before Trump was even thinking of running for president, let alone Manafort thinking that he was going to become a campaign manager for a short time.
Yeah, there's two issues here, and let's separate them. One is the issue of what Mueller is saying about Manafort. He's saying we're no longer obliged to carry out our plea deal agreement with him because he's committed crimes and lies. And now this happened, Daniel Lazar, 1 week or just a few days, actually, after Donald Trump submitted in writing through his lawyers answers to questions for the Mueller probe. That's one issue. The one issue is what's happened between Mueller and Manafort and what it might mean. And then the second issue is, did Paul Manafort actually meet with Julian Assange in 2016? Part of it was, according to this author, Luke Harding, took place in the spring of 2016 at the time before Manafort was chairman of Donald Trump's election campaign, but while he was starting to work with Donald Trump. Now, Manafort says 100% not true. And Daniel Lazar, WikiLeaks has bet The Guardian, which published the story, $1 million that it's untrue. Now, you know, WikiLeaks, by the way, hasn't published anything that's not true as of now. So anyway, what's your take on the second issue, the Julian Assange Manafort meeting, which WikiLeaks and Manafort say did not happen?
Well, first of all, I also would point out that Luke Harding, one of the two authors of the story, is heavily invested in this paranoid Russiagate conspiracy theory.
I'm glad you brought that up. That's important.
Yeah, it's very important. And so, therefore, I regard him as far less reliable than WikiLeaks or even Manafort. But still, no, we don't know. I mean, maybe the meeting did occur. If it did occur, then the logical assumption is that maybe they were talking about, they were somehow coordinating stuff about emails, even though the emails had not been acquired by that point by WikiLeaks, but maybe some kind of collusion was going on. It seems highly dubious to me, but it's certainly a possibility, and it certainly is why everybody is intensely focused on that alleged meeting.
Yeah, Harding, who's the author of this Guardian piece, by the way, the Guardian article, which asserts that Assange and Manafort met at the Ecuadorian embassy, it's now gone through multiple changes, and the changes are really fascinating.
And they're significant changes.
Very significant changes. But I want to play an audio clip since Daniel mentioned the author, Luke Harding. Now, Harding has written a book, and the book is called Collusion, Secret Meetings, Dirty Money, and How Russia Helped Donald Trump Win. So obviously, Luke Harding has a position on all of this, and he wrote a book about it, presumably trying to make money off of his book. He had an interview with The Real News, Aaron Mate. Mate's interview with Harding, again, was so revealing about who Luke Harding is. I want to play a clip. It's a minute and 25 seconds, but let's listen to this exchange between Aaron Mate and Luke Harding, the author of this allegation.
Meanwhile, we have George Papadopoulos, foreign policy aide to Donald Trump, who in the spring of last year is running around my town, where I am, London, meeting a mysterious professor who features in Miller's indictment with contacts to Moscow who tells Papadopoulos.
Well, hold on a second, Luke. He tells Papadopoulos that he has contacts to Moscow. We actually have no clue what those contacts are. His name is Joseph Massoud, right? He's a professor in the UK right now. And Papadopoulos claims that Massoud told him that he has high-level Russian government contacts. But so far, there's been no even proof of that.
Well, it's in the indictment. I mean, either you kind of live in the empirical world or you don't. But I mean,
no, in the empirical world, in the indictment, Massoud claims that he is, or Papadopoulos says that Massoud claimed he had Russian government ties, but that doesn't mean it's true.
Well, no, but a lot of very good journalists, both in the US and elsewhere, have obviously tried to get in touch with Mr. Massoud to kind of try and talk to him, and we haven't had kind of much luck, but I mean, I think you have to kind of understand the context, which is that what happened in the US last year isn't divorced from other kind of Russian influence operations, particularly where I sit in Europe. This is not a new movie; it's a kind of old movie.
Daniel Lazar, any reaction there?
Yeah, a lot of reaction. I mean, first of all, what Harding is saying is that the Russians do this kind of stuff. Therefore, the presumption is that they're guilty. Therefore, proof is secondary. Secondly, all the evidence suggests, contrary to Harding, that Massoud had close ties to Western intelligence, not the Russian government, but Western intelligence, which makes the whole encounter between him and Papadopoulos all the more mysterious, and which undercuts the easy narrative that Harding is peddling about a great Russian conspiracy. The whole affair is very strange. It's very murky, and I think the underlying story here is very different than the Harding conspiracy tale we're getting.
All right, Colleen Raleigh, let's go to the other side of this issue and back to the reason that Mueller has said that the agreement with Manafort is off and that he's no longer going to offer any sort of recommendation to the judge that there be some leniency for Manafort. I'm looking at a Washington Post story that came out this afternoon, and I want to read a couple sentences to you from it and then get your reaction. The government will file a detailed sentencing submission to the probation department and the court in advance of sentencing that sets forth the nature of the defendant's crimes and lies. That's from Mueller announcing why they've suspended or how they're going to explain to the court why they're suspending the agreement with Manafort. And then the Post writer writes, the words detailed sentencing submission, close quote, loom large. Mueller's team has always been tight-lipped publicly, but it has made some key disclosures through indictments often referred to as speaking indictments. The indictments of 13 Russians earlier this year contained extensive detail and was perhaps more about disclosure than punishment, given the Russians almost definitely will never be in the United States to face trial. The initial Manafort indictment disclosed that he was viewed as a key witness not just generally, but specifically with regard to a potential Trump campaign collusion with Russian, a pregnant inclusion. The Mueller filing on Manafort's alleged lies won't be an indictment per se, and there is a very real chance it could remain under seal to protect the ongoing investigation. But if it is made public, it would give Mueller a chance to say whatever he feels like disclosing, and notably without Whitaker, the acting attorney general's approval, which would be required for a new indictment or for releasing a final report. Colleen Raleigh, what this article is suggesting is that Mueller could use the sentencing submission, the detailed sentencing submission, not as a proved document, but simply as an allegation to be able to, quote, talk. In other words, to tell Mueller's side of the story. Does this seem plausible to you?
It's unusual, but it certainly is plausible in this day and age of perception management. Because, you know, people find out that facts these days don't, you know, we can go all the way back to the Iraq War. And I mean, all these, that the facts, and even Karl Rove said this, you know, many people, it's basically now what you can make people believe. And using the media and even using sentencing reports, et cetera, are going to work wonderful, you know, intelligence assessments. These things are going to work wonderful for that purpose, even though they would not hold up in a court of law. And as the article mentioned, the indictment of the 13 Russians that they claimed were trolling and stuff on social media is very similar, because it will never go into a court. So, yeah, that certainly is possible. And even this final report that Mueller writes could be in that same vein. It's like I said, it's unusual. And certainly I retired in 2004. And I don't think this was done nearly. It may have been done in some cases, but honestly, I don't think it was done nearly to the extent that it seems to be going on right now. It's very sad. If, in fact, Mueller miscalculated, again, giving him the plea deal before he understood what Manafort was actually privy to, what he actually would say, I said that's actually unusual, because in these proffers, they are very careful to make to get the information from the person before they offer the deal. And, of course, Mueller doesn't want to be looked at as if he's miscalculated. So the question would be, what other... does he have any other facts that would then show that Manafort has not told the truth? Obviously, like I said before, I think everyone who has gone into the Ecuador embassy since Assange has been in there has been noted, duly noted by surveillance. And so this question of whether Manafort did or did not meet with Assange seems to me that wouldn't even be an issue, because there would be ways to verify that. And maybe possibly Manafort didn't remember the date that he had met or something like that. And so Mueller is exaggerating the fact that he couldn't remember the exact date or month that he met with him in 2013. And, you know, to basically say, well, he didn't tell the truth. That's possible. There's a lot of possibilities, and you can speculate until all day long on what may or may not have gone wrong. It's just with this plea deal that didn't work out. But there was a miscalculation on somebody's part there, that's for sure.
We're speaking from Minnesota with Colleen Raleigh, a former FBI special agent who in 2002 was named Time Magazine's Person of the Year, along with two other whistleblowers. And we're speaking from New York with Daniel Lazar, a journalist and the author of three books, The Frozen Republic, The Velvet Coup, and America's Undeclared War. Daniel, picking up on what Colleen has just spoken about, several different journalists have been tweeting this afternoon about this article, and they make a very compelling argument that this is bogus. There's one tweet from Hannah Jonasson from the Assange legal team, says the authors of the bogus Guardian story, Dan Collins and Luke Harding, were in Ecuador 10 days ago with U.S. funded Via Vicencio, who they have previously bylined with in other bogus stories. This picture was taken last week, and there's a picture of the three of them together. And then another journalist says they cite documents from CNAIN, Ecuador's intelligence agency, currently being disbanded because of dubious activities. They have fabricated documents before to serve their agenda, and they definitely are out for Assange because he published some of their secret documents. It seems like there are different pieces of this thing falling into place. Along with the story being bylined Quito and not London, along with your comment that that these guys are not trustworthy journalists. So is this thing falling apart before our eyes? Are we going to see a retraction, do you think?
It's very possible. I'd be delighted if that was the case. But it's possible we'll see a retraction. I just think the Guardian itself has been hyper aggressive in pursuing this Russiagate story. It has distorted the truth at every turn. I think it's really disgraced. It's a disgrace to journalism. And Harding is the most aggressive of the most aggressive. So he has really been out front in pushing this line, and it has not held up to close inspection. So my working assumption is this latest story will not hold up either. But look, I mean, the thing about Manafort and Mueller, I mean, maybe Mueller has come across additional information that suggests that Manafort is holding back or lying, but maybe Mueller is just simply frustrated that Manafort is not telling him what he wants to know. He has the guy Manafort is now in solitary confinement. He's sick. He apparently he appeared in court recently with his foot in a bandage, and Manafort is tightening the screws, trying to make the guy talk, but maybe there's nothing for him to say.
Right.
Maybe there's nothing there. That's a very strong possibility, and I personally think that is what's most likely.
And you know, people really aren't talking about that. Like, what if Manafort really doesn't have anything left to say? Then what? Colleen, when you've entered into a plea agreement, like the kind of plea agreement we think Manafort has entered into, what happens if you just simply have nothing left to say? What happens if they've made you an offer, you've accepted the offer, and then the information you provide either isn't good enough or doesn't help them? Then what happens?
Well, that's exactly what I was alluding to initially with these proffers. Again, you go back. Mueller should have pretty much known what Manafort was going to say. Now, one way that he might have known is if there was an independent bit of information gathered from an independent investigation. So there may be some tidbits that he knew already from different ways. And one would be prior surveillance, et cetera, you know, of Manafort, whatever. So that's a way that he then can try to ascertain whether Manafort is telling the truth or not, if he actually had some info. Then besides that, there's the proffer, which, you know, he says, this is what I know. Okay, that is enough information for me. Because if he didn't have, going back to what you said, if he simply did not have any information about Russian collusion, you know, and he was asked, and if he said, nope, I really don't know anything about that, frankly, would Mueller have offered him a deal? That's the thing, you know, you don't give deals to people who don't know anything. You have to, you know, Sammy the Bull Gravano, who was a multi-murderer or whatever, got a pretty great plea deal, even though he murdered a whole bunch of people. And the reason for that was he was going to testify against Gotti, who was his boss and a higher up. If you don't have this knowledge of dirt, the prosecutor does not give you the deal to begin with. So it goes back to what I said. There's been some miscalculation here one way or the other. Now, maybe Mueller was hoping that he could somehow, yes, coerce or push Manafort to say something. But if he's in that position, then he himself has to have some facts to know what's the truth or not. If he doesn't have the facts and he's merely, you know, pushing for information, you know, that can actually, with a weak-minded person, that can actually make somebody make up stuff in some cases, because they want to please the prosecutor in order to, defense attorneys try to make these points all the time with plea deals that the prosecutors push too hard for info, and the person on the witness stand simply wants to get off, and so they are, you know, embellish the truth, you know, in some ways. So there's, like I said, there's been a miscalculation on somebody's part here, and the question is what actual facts may or may not exist, and who knows if we'll find that out in a sentencing agreement. It's not really likely. Manafort was well known to have engaged in kind of the money laundering part, that kind of stuff. And he'll, you know, that's kind of what they knew that they had facts about that. They had documents and everything else. If they merely want a witness to say things that they already know, then, you know, they maybe were attempting to get Manafort to say those things that they already know. Or, in essence, they didn't know anything, and Manafort also didn't know anything.
Daniel Lazar, we've got like 30 seconds left. I have to ask you really quickly. Do you think that this could have all come from Donald Trump's written responses to Mueller's questions?
I mean, those responses were heavily lawyered. Mm-hmm. So therefore, I think that Trump would not disclose anything that would get him or in trouble or fuel Mueller's investigation. But, you know, but it's always a possibility. I just wanted to point out one thing, that Mueller, in February 2003, testified that Saddam, the eve of the invasion of Iraq, testified before Congress that Saddam Hussein was hiding vast quantities of WMDs and was the primary source of international terrorism. Now, so obviously what that shows is that Mueller's relationship with empirical reality, to quote Luke Harding, is a challenging one. Okay. So maybe the guy is like, you know, is kind of in the same kind of like, you know, netherworld as well, where the thesis precedes the proof.
We were joined from Minnesota by Colleen Rowley. Colleen's a former FBI special agent who in 2002 was named Time Magazine's Person of the Year, along with two other whistleblowers. And we were joined from New York by Daniel Lazar, a journalist and the author of The Frozen Republic, The Velvet Coup, and America's Undeclared War. Stay tuned to Loud and Clear. We have a lot more coming up.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
Nikki Haley, the U.S. ambassador to the United Nations, accused Russia on Monday of taking, quote, outlaw actions, unquote, against Ukrainian ships in an incident at sea this weekend, and vowed that sanctions punishing Russia's annexation of Crimea would continue. Haley said, quote, outlaw actions like this one continue to make an improvement in U.S. relations impossible. The United States will maintain its Crimea-related sanctions against Russia. Indeed, further Russian escalation of this kind will only make matters worse, unquote. Donald Trump's comments, however, struck a different tone from Haley's. We're joined from Moscow by Mark Sloboda. He's an international relations and security analyst. Welcome back, Mark.
John, Brian, thanks for having me. It's always an honor and a pleasure to be on Loud and Clear.
Well, thank you, Mark. And I have to start off by asking you, what would Russia possibly have to gain by initiating a conflict like this?
As far as I can see, nothing. Because obviously, as Nikki Haley pointed out, this would only worsen the perception of Russia with the West and possibly lead to an increase in sanctions against the country. It doesn't seem to gain any military victory. There has been some speculation in the Western media that it is about Putin's approval rating, which is sitting at 62%, while taking a dip from the recent announcement of pension reform in the country, is still well above any Western leader's levels, and Putin is not ever running for re-election. This is his last presidential term. So I don't think that really provides any explanation or motivation for what the Western media and governments are presenting as happened at this incident in the Sea of Azov.
Mark Sloboda, let's contrast Nikki Haley and Mike Pompeo's comments. Haley's were more sort of strident even than Pompeo's. Pompeo's was an official statement from the State Department. But Trump's comments were significantly different in tone and in substance, and I'd like to just get your comment on it. And of course, this takes place in the context of the political context that we are a week out or a few days out, in fact, from the G20 meeting, and there was a question of whether Putin and Trump would meet for a second time along the sidelines of the G20. Here's what Trump said. Quote, either way, we don't like what's happening, and hopefully it will get straightened out. I know Europe is not, they are not thrilled. They are working on it too. We're all working on it together. I mean, that's quite a bit different from Nikki Haley's comments.
The difference has been noted by the, shall we say, extremely strident anti-Russian commentators in the Western mainstream media and commentariat, and they are reading that across Twitter and in social media and in their reporting as evidence, further evidence of Trump Putin collusion, being that it's not as strong as the voices out of his own administration. Never mind, of course, that the assessments, the statements out of Europe, the official statements from Germany and from others, France included, are also relatively neutral in tone, perhaps indicating that they are actually paying attention to the details of the incident and that it, they aren't jumping on Russia because as strongly because of that.
You have to look at a map of the Black Sea and the Sea of Azov. The Sea of Azov is right above the Kerch Strait. On one side is Ukraine. On the north to the west is Crimea, which was a part of Russia and then became part of Ukraine in 1954 when both of those countries were one country in the Soviet Union. When Khrushchev transferred authority to Ukraine, the Republic of Ukraine within the Soviet Union. On the eastern side is Russia. And those straits are very, very, very narrow. And those both countries have access to the Sea of Azov. Both of those countries have been having their ships routinely go through these straits. They've been doing it without incident even since 2014 when the Crimea referendum happened, where people overwhelmingly voted to go back to Russia, to reaffix Crimea to Russia. Why now, Mark Sloboda? Why did this happen now after 4 years where even with the war in the eastern part of Ukraine, what the West calls the annexation of Crimea, what Russia calls the referendum, there was no martial law during those big, big struggles. Why now?
Yeah, so the Kerch Straits is extremely narrow, and it's the only way to pass from the Black Sea into the Sea of Azov. In fact, it's the only way to go in and out of the Sea of Azov to begin with. And the Sea of Azov is an extremely shallow sea with an average depth of like 21 feet, which actually means most military naval vessels can't operate there, because their draft is simply too big to operate there. It's quite funny when you see Atlantic Council fellows like Anders Asland calling for NATO to send its navy into the Sea of Azov. First of all, not only would it be illegal, but they simply couldn't operate there and it would immediately run aground. So it's quite humorous.
That's actually funny.
It's made even more tight, of course, because the bridge that Russia built over the Kerch Straits to connect mainland Russia on the Kerch Peninsula with the Crimea means that there's only one place now to go through the Kerch Straits, right underneath a movable section of the bridge. So it's extremely tight. And navigation there, because it's so shallow, is extremely difficult, right? It's extremely complex. It's dangerous. There was a 2003 treaty between the then, you know, presidents of Ukraine and Russia, you know, that's still in force, that sets very specific guidelines for how to pass through the Kerch Straits into the Sea of Azov. It declares that the Sea of Azov is internal waters of shared of both Russia and Ukraine. They are not international waters, and both countries have free usage of the waters of the Sea of Azov. But the procedure for entering the Kerch Straits requires that any ship, commercial, military, contact the port authorities in Kerch, give identifying information about their cargo, their destination, their size, their draft, receive navigation instructions, right, depending on the tides because of the dangerous situation there. And Russia pays all the more attention to this because of the Crimean Bridge and the fact that Ukrainian politicians and officials have repeatedly called for the destruction, to destroy the Crimean Bridge. They take security very situation, especially when it comes to Ukrainian military ships. For 4 years, passage in and out, commercial, military, right, Ukrainian, you know, despite the change in government in Kiev, no problems because they followed the protocols. Yesterday, they didn't. Why didn't they? It, you know, the answer is clear. It was a political provocation. The Ukraine, West-backed Ukrainian putsch president, quote, president, unquote, the oligarch Poroshenko, is going into presidential elections in 4 months. His approval rating is a whopping 8 8%. This is the quote president of the popular revolution in Ukraine. 8%. He's desperate to do anything. Now, of course, his closest rival, the former prime minister, the gas princess, also an oligarch, Yulia Tymoshenko, her approval rating is 18%. So not that much better. There's room to close that gap. And a little bit of military patriotic excitement presenting him as the protector of the country against Russian aggression is exactly what was called for. And the fact that even the Ukrainian intelligence service, the SBU, has admitted that they had an intelligence official on both of the one on each of these two gunboats that were involved. You know, we're talking a total crew of 24. So out of those 24, two of them were Ukrainian intelligence. Why? It is assumed they had special orders to create this provocation by not following the protocols.
Yeah, very important fact. So now we have, on the eve of the election, the unpopular Poroshenko creating, what Mark is telling us at least, a military provocation with the idea of whipping up nationalist patriotic fervor, and perhaps under the conditions of martial law, postponing the elections even, because that certainly is within the provisions of the martial law bill or law within Ukraine. Mark, do you think Russia, people have been asking us this, even if Russia is right, did Russia overreact by stopping the vessel or by shooting at it?
That's really easy to say. First of all, it's clear that, you know, they gave orders, they had ships followed, they came in close contact with them, right? They repeatedly ordered them to stop, right? They ignored that. They actually, on their ships, they uncovered their guns, the machine guns, mounted machine guns on the ship. They uncovered them, which, of course, is preparation for use. They didn't actually use them. But that's the time when Russia first fired warning shots and then fired, when they weren't heated either, fired to disable the engines of the ship. And the fact that no one was killed, actually, so three crewmen were injured, that's actually extremely, it shows extreme restraint as far as I'm concerned.
Those Ukrainian sailors cannot be happy.
I'm sure the Ukrainian sailors aren't happy. If I were them, I would not be happy at the putsch president that sent them into this near suicidal position. You know, Russia has to take the security of the bridge extremely seriously, particularly when Ukraine has called to destroy it.
We're going to have to leave it there. That was the voice of Mark Sloboda, who joined us from Moscow. Mark is an international relations and security analyst. You're listening to Loud and Clear. Stay tuned. We'll take a short break and come right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
The Mississippi Senate race will be decided in a runoff election today that pits former Congressman and Agriculture Secretary Mike Espy against incumbent Republican Senator Cindy Hyde-Smith. Hyde-Smith has found herself at the center of controversy over the past couple of weeks over her previous support for Confederate symbols and monuments. Espy is the strongest possible Democrat to challenge Hyde-Smith, but polls show that the Republican will keep her seat. We're joined from New York by Ted Rall, an award-winning editorial cartoonist and columnist. You can check out his great work at Rall.com. Ted, welcome back.
Thanks for having me, guys.
Ted, you and Brian and I have talked about this race in the past couple of weeks, and we all sort of agreed that while Espy is the strongest Democrat, this is a Republican seat and the Republicans are going to keep it. Is there any reason to think differently now?
It's getting tighter, but I think the Republicans are still going to keep it. There's signs that Republicans are worried because the gap has narrowed. President Trump has decided to focus some of his attention to try to rally the Republican base down there. But I still don't think the gap is not going to close completely. I think the Republicans are still going to keep this seat.
I'm wondering too if we're beginning to see, or if Democrats want us to think that we're seeing the beginning of a new Mississippi. I think that they have in their minds what happened with Doug Jones in Alabama, that black women came together as a group, as a block, and voted for the Democrat there, and that they're hoping the same thing might happen in Mississippi. I'm not sure that I see that, but can you see a scenario, Ted, where Mississippi perhaps begins to turn purple like Georgia seems to be?
Yes, but I don't think it's going to be anytime soon. The demographics just don't point in that direction. Black women in the South are a significant voting bloc. In fact, arguably, they may have been critical, aside from DNC shenanigans, at keeping Bernie Sanders from winning the Democratic nomination last time around. So it's not like it's not a real phenomenon. I just don't think we're going to see Mississippi, of all states, become a purple state anytime soon. I mean, let's just say we should table this conversation for another 8 to 12 years.
You know, Brian, I was very interested to read recently that Mississippi has the third largest population of African Americans in the country, but they have the fewest by percentage number of African Americans who are registered to vote. And I wonder if that's one of the reasons why Democrats just can't seem to make any headway in Mississippi.
Well, there's movements afoot. I mean, there's the movement, including the city government in Jackson, Mississippi, and Jackson has a very, very large black population. The development that started with Chukwue Lumumba's victory as mayor of Jackson. There is a lot of political grassroots activity going on inside the black community. Mississippi, again, for our audience that may not know, it was the hardest, or certainly one of the hardest states to crack the nut in terms of official apartheid desegregation. So even though 60% of the population is white and 36%, more than one third, is African American, the level of oppression and the level of repression in Mississippi, the level of terror, the history and legacy of lynchings and police violence, it's left a big mark. So has poverty in general. I mean, just one of the poorest places, certainly in the United States. All of that is impacting this race. Now, there's the other element. You mentioned, you know, we had the comments by the Republican candidate that she was prepared to go to be at the front of a public hanging. I mean, black people understand that to be a reference to lynchings, which were not uncommon at all in the state of Mississippi, a dog whistle signaling white racists in Mississippi, hey, I'm still with you, you know what I'm talking about. And then whenever these dog whistles are called out, the perpetrator of the racist dog whistle says, oh, I was just joking. It's a joke. It's a joke. Of course, you can't really joke about lynchings. It would be like Germans, non-Jewish Germans, making jokes about the Holocaust. I mean, it's actually not acceptable.
No.
And you can't josh around like that. But there's the other element, which is after the 1954 civil rights decision in the Supreme Court, Brown versus the Board of Education, which outlawed segregation in public schools, Mississippi became the vanguard of the segregation academies. And the Republican candidate made sure her kids, like these other white families' kids, could avoid having to go to school with black kids by putting them in what are called segregation academies. That's what they're called in Mississippi.
Shocking.
And Hyde Smith made sure that her kids were in the segregation academy. That's all part of the politics, the history, the culture. And it's not ancient history. It's not even history. It's the present in terms of what people are facing in Mississippi. Go ahead, Ted.
I mean, culturally, that's absolutely true. I mean, look, if you're new to the United States and you want to know where the Deep South is, Mississippi is the deepest of the Deep South, along with Alabama. Now, that said, what's interesting politically is that the divide in this country is such that when a state skews far to the Republican side, it doesn't skew quite as far as you might think by international or European standards. Mississippi is really a 40% Democratic state, reliably during presidential elections, probably inching up more to 41 or 42 these days. So, you know, we're not talking about some radical tilt 1585, but still, that's as Republican as it gets in the United States. And we have some very Republican states. So the legacy of white supremacy that is, of course, as Brian pointed out, ongoing, is it's a very, very big thing to mount. I mean, to fight against. It's, blacks are fighting demographics and they're fighting cultural and political inertia among the whites that, quite frankly, they need enough whites to vote Democratic or be progressive or liberal in order to be able to start getting some statewide candidates into office that reflect their values and their interests.
Any predictions then? You're predicting a Republican victory tonight. Ted, we've asked you your predictions over the past 2 years. I think I think you have a pretty good track record, actually. I hate to admit it, given our own track record, which has been appallingly bad. Matter of fact, we decided we would never make any predictions about anything after the November 2016 election.
That's a good policy.
But go ahead.
Well, the reason is because you guys are much more optimistic and have a better view of human nature and the arc of history than I do. I think progress just always takes longer than one would hope or think. And that's kind of why I think I view things that way. I'm going to say this race is definitely going to is going to go Republican. The much will be made, I think, as it was in Texas in the Beto O'Rourke, Ted Cruz campaign, about closing the gap and more than you would think that the Democrat will beat the spread. I think that's true, and I think it's a state to watch, but if I were Democrats, I would not be spending much money there in the near future if they were going to prioritize it. I mean, they have a lot more to do in states like Colorado and Arizona. Now, that's potential. Those are Democratic pickups in the future.
I think you're right. Well, that was the voice of Ted Rall, who joined us from New York. Ted is an award-winning editorial cartoonist and a columnist, and you can check out his work at www.rall.com. You've been listening to Loud and Clear. We're completely out of time. Be sure to go to our Facebook page, Loud and Clear with Brian Becker, for daily updates. If you enjoy the show and want your friends to hear it, let us know by liking the page on Facebook. And you can follow us now on Twitter at Loud Clear Radio. You can also hear us every day, Monday through Friday, from 4 to 6 p.m. on 105.5 FM and 1390 AM in the Washington, D.C. area. You can also hear us at SputnikNews.com and as a podcast at iTunes and at iHeartRadio. Remember, telling the truth is important, but to make a difference, it has to be loud and clear. We'll see you next time.
Loud and Clear.
Oh.